Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June the 18th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, we're going to be listening in on a Holden forum. Tonight's topic, after the baptism, what next? Fostering faith. Let's listen in.
Let's roll the tape.
My name is Deanne Lagerquist. This summer I'm serving as the teaching staff coordinator. And in the course of that coordination, I've been thinking a lot about this summer's theme, Water Washed, Spirit Born. It's a baptismal theme, but also a vocational theme to help us think about the way we arise out of the waters, answering God's call to us to go out. And once a week, we're scheduling a forum where we can explore in a conversation some of the implications of that baptismal washing and then calling. A forum at Holden is sometimes about something very controversial and sometimes not. But in either case, our primary goal is to learn from each other. We don't expect necessarily to come to the formula or the correct answer or the guarantee that will solve all the world's problems or even the small one that we've bitten off to chew on that night. What we hope for is that by listening to each other, we will benefit from each other's expertise and wisdom and questions and desires and longings and all those gifts that we bring to each other. One of my mixed gifts, I guess, is that I'm a timekeeper with some agenda anxiety. And what that means for you tonight is that we start promptly and we end after an hour. This is not, as I may have suggested, because I think we will have come to a final conclusion, but rather because we won't. And the conversation then continues in other places, at coffee break, at meals, on the trail, etc. And I expect that we will each hear from someone tonight, something that makes us want to talk to that person more. And I encourage you then to take the initiative to follow up. Okay, with that introduction, tonight's theme about the theme is, after the baptism, what next? And Dan has set us up very nicely for that with his sessions and then with tonight's Vespers. We talk about the baptism and then that wonderful story that he told us of Brian, who for whom the next step was to wash all the assembled congregation's feet. But more explicitly tonight, more specifically, our question is, how do we foster faith? And last week we talked about making various kinds of promises. Perhaps this is a form in which we can think about how the promises, the parents, the sponsors, the congregation, the baptized one make at the font are carried out and brought into a more mature and full life. Three people have agreed to start us off. I refer to these people as the pump primers. That is to say, they should get the conversation flowing, but they're not here primarily as the ones with all the answers, although you're certainly welcome to ask them questions. And I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves, and we'll just go in the order that you are.
I'm Steve Larson, Maverick, here the last 3 weeks, and a parish pastor.
I'm Susan Briel, director at the Village, and pastor and the parent.
And Dan Erlander, and I guess I'm half-time parish pastor and the other half-time for some writing and cartooning,
things like that. Why don't you start?
Oh, okay. When I became a pastor, one of the things that I wanted to avoid was teaching. I just thought I never want to teach. But it was really exciting as I, in my early years of ministry, I actually enjoyed things like confirmation and youth work. And one of the things that in my first small parish that I served that was really magical was we always had this problem of getting snowed out in January, and all the Sunday school teachers were saying it was hard to get substitutes and everything like that. So I suggested that we have 5 Sunday school classes for the month of January, that they be intergenerational for the whole congregation, and they would be by subject area. And so children chose classes that their parents weren't in, by and large. And so we had people from 3 months old to 83 years old in 5 Sunday school classes on one of the mission fields, the travels of Paul, Advent devotion, or no, it wasn't Advent, it was Epiphany devotions, things like that. And then the 5th week, we all got together and we taught each other the things that we had learned and gathered and the songs that we had done. And it was just a magical kind of thing. So after that, I decided when I did my Doctor of Ministry project, I wanted to learn more about education involving everyone in the congregation. And so my doctoral paper was The Priesthood of All Believers as Guiding Principle for Parish Educational Theory and Methods. And what it boils down to is that parish education at its best takes seriously the priesthood of all believers. But the sad thing is that in the Lutheran Church, we've got this wonderful doctrine of all being priests of our God in our baptism, and yet we don't live it out very well at all in our parish educational programs. There are hints, you know, that we really want this to happen in our churches. And our annual Sunday School Christmas program is probably one of those ongoing traditions that emphasizes the priesthood of all believers. But even that, in most parishes, you know, we have the kids get up with their note that says, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news." And rather than letting the kids interpret the story for us and say, "Don't be afraid, we've got wonderful things to tell you," in their own words. And so where I come out in the thesis is that parish education at its best is a ministry of all the baptized. And we need to have lots of opportunities for in music and in sharing. Actually, sharing is the most common word in the whole thesis. That we need to share with one another. We need to share with our children. We need to give our children the opportunity to share the faith with us. We can't just feel that someday these people are going to be ministers and priests of our God and believers. We need to live it out all the time in parish education. So, you know, I have lots of suggestions in that about how that would be worked out. But a congregation that takes that seriously has lots of skits, lots of operettas, lots of sharing that's going on where our children minister with us and to us. Lots of intergenerational things that happen.
I think after the baptism immediately, in the baptism immediately, the child is brought into a Eucharistic community, and that faith is fostered as that child comes to live more and more deeply in a Eucharistic community, not only fed as early as possible with the bread and wine, the very presence of Christ Jesus, but also as the child is helped and led and encouraged to see how worship, the Eucharistic community, binds this child to a life of servanthood, to a life of peacemaking and justice seeking, how this Eucharistic community binds the child to a life of intercessory prayer, how the domestic rituals that happen at the family table are bound in texture and in meaning to everything that happens in the sanctuary on Sunday. So for me, the nurturing of faith, the fostering of faith, is life in a Eucharistic community, which means life in a community that runs against the current of the world. And the earlier that we teach children that being fostered in the faith, that we confess means living against the world in many instances, the more deeply that faith will be fostered. It runs according to a different calendar, different way of ordering time, a different way of understanding value, a different way of understanding relationship, a different way of understanding the world than most of the child's peers will. So part of fostering faith for me is helping a child understand that she will in fact be different, and that in fact will bring pain, and that in fact it will bring joy. And this all comes up for me out of a Eucharistic community.
I read a quote in our class tonight from William Willimon about, called Peculiar Speech, and it's a guidebook on helping preachers to preach when they feel like their sermons are kind of slowing down. It's called Preaching to the Baptized. And this, I think it's a sense that after baptism, the question, is there going to be a community there to receive? I'm talking especially here about infant baptism, but it certainly would also include adult baptism. Do we have a community there that's going to receive this child to really feel like an important member, a brother and sister in Christ? And this fits in with how we are counterculture in the world, but William Willimon, who's a Methodist teacher, theologian, liturgical scholar, campus pastor, without that act of prophetic resistance and reformation, all our vaunted talk of freedom, and this is kind of he means here the normal American use of the word freedom, is but the rattling of the chains binding us to the authoritarianism of a liberal democratic culture, a culture that, whether it intended to do so or not, destroys human community by fragmenting us into a herd of isolated units, each detached from tradition, community, history, and one another, all the while telling us that we are free. Ironically, in such a condition, detached from sources of true meaning, we have not gained our individuality, but have lost it. For true individualism comes only for someone who knows and who can name who she is. Of course, the democratic empire now knows what the monarchs of old did not. Detached, rootless, historyless individuals are more easily managed than people in groups, people who have names, people who have stories, histories, and a home. I think there's a lot of power in that, and I have a memory of when I served a parish in Albuquerque, New Mexico, before coming to Holden Village. This would have been in, I don't know when that was, late 70s? Is that right?
75, 80.
Yeah, late 70s. We rented our Sunday school building to a Orthodox Jewish parochial school during the week. And it was a wonderful experience, because when I had a question about the Old Testament, I'd just go downstairs to the principal of the school. But sometimes the noise level would really be high, so I'd leave my office to go down the hall to the social hall to find out where all the noise was coming from. And I remember walking in to that room, and they had turned our social hall into Egypt, the Red Sea, the wilderness, and the Promised Land. And the kids were all dressed up in their parts. And the children of Israel were going across the paper Red Sea. And Pharaoh was there chasing them. And they were screaming. And Miriam was singing. And the next Sunday, I kind of walked down to our Sunday school rooms, you know, where they were all had their books out that we don't really try. But I thought of the difference how these children were being immersed into the story of the baptism of their people, the Jewish people. They were being storied. Is that right? And I just thought, how more can children grow up just being in the story, with the story, hearing the story, and also understanding that to be in this story, to say yes to this story, is to say no to another story. And that is the story of violence as a way to bring about good. That is the story of wealth as a way to happiness. That is the story of shopping will bring you joy. There are all these other stories, and to teach children that in our home, we have another story and we're immersed into that story. The other thing to share is that I, in working on this little booklet on baptism, I had the chance of talking to David Anderson, and there's 1,000 David Andersons in the ELCA, so all I know is his name is David Anderson, who works back at Augsburg Fortress, where they're honestly working on resources for families and parents to teach the faith in the home by doing ritual things, by not just having kind of that 3-minute religious time, but how do we teach parents to have the resources to live the Christian life at home in a ritual life? And found out from him the leaders in the Lutheran Church in the world for this have been the Church of Norway. And the Church of Norway has developed marvelous resources to help Christian parents teach at home. And they're hearing and listening and compiling ideas and studying the resources from the Norwegian church to try to bring that. Because he said over the phone to me, he says, with all of the voices in our culture that are calling our children, teaching our children another story, we can't do it in 1 hour a week or in Sunday school classes. It has to be every day, every hour of the day, with sensitized, conscientious parents, whom Luther called prophets, priests, and bishops. And he said both mother and father are the prophets, priests, and bishops in the home, the highest calling. And notice he said mother and father, not just the father is the spiritual leader of the home, mother and father. Oh, is that enough?
That gets us started. There are quite a few strands we could follow. The issue is about education and how we do that in the context of the congregation. Issues related to worship, both the congregation's worship and in the home. Helping children, not just fostering faith, but the way that fostering faith develops identity, particularly this identity of oddness or counterculturalness. And then I think just the other thing that we could do that might be a good way to start to get our tongues moving is to talk about very specific things that people have done or have heard of other people doing, whether it's in Sunday school or confirmation or in home, that you think have been valuable and worth sharing with others. So.
Yeah, I was struck at the time of Vatican II when I just happened to hear a number of priests from Europe who had been at those sessions and had now come to the U.S. to talk, by their stories. And they were talking about how their own personal stories of faith were set in a church that officially had commanded them to hear only particular stories and not to hear other stories. And yet they heard those other stories. And they knew that those stories were powerful stories within which they wished to live, sometimes from Jewish people, sometimes from Hindu people, from Protestant Christians, and so forth. And now they found that their church was in a way saying to them, it's a new story and we can hear those other stories. And sometimes with tears running down their faces, they were praising this moment in which God had touched them. Now officially through the church channels to say, okay, it's now permissible in this community out loud to say we can hear each other's stories. But I think often as Protestants, we have been pretty smug and said, well, we always knew that. But we haven't, I think, been clear enough with each other in our priesthood of all believers that we need to hear stories that don't come through official channels, that aren't necessarily the pastor's story or the church administrator's story of what it means to be in this group.
Something happened about a year ago. I was riding my bike about 6:30 in the morning, and I went past the local high school. There were probably about 100 boys out there for football practice, and 20 coaches, and parents had dropped them off. And at least anyone think I don't like sports. I do. But I've often marveled at the amount of energy and resources that parents will put into athletics. And I thought, could we ever get 200 boys and 20 fathers in our community anyway, out there at 6:30 in the morning to do anything that had to do with spirituality? And I had to say the answer probably is absolutely not. And I thought it would be an interesting thing, we haven't done it yet, to have the parents of our congregation do a time chart and keep track of how much time they spend running their kids to practices, buying equipment, watching their games, how much time their kids spend in practice, how much time they spend watching professionals on TV play these games, and then compare that with how much they spend giving the other story during the week. And I think it would be astounding. And then to wonder what's going wrong. So that's something that I am followed through with as part of our education program. But to me, it really strikes me that the commitment that parents will put into kids in sports is so, so much larger than what they put into their spiritual efforts.
I share a quote, just a quickie, but when I was studying this, that it's a quote from somebody that the vocation of parents in American society is to provide transportation for their children to take them to the people who will influence them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think parents are pretty hungry to have that role. Our church is kind of just starting on a path, and it will be interesting to see how far it goes. And it sort of happened in different areas, different ways. In the youth program, we have a lot of youth staff for a congregation. We've got a part-time youth pastor plus a youth worker, plus we're thinking now about a junior high youth worker, but there's a very large adult mentor program, and the role of the youth pastor is to train all the adults who care and things like that. And so in the youth program, we will have 60 to 90 kids there on a Monday night for peer-led Bible studies, but then the parents are there to help set up and be there and things. And then in other class, there's a parents in partnership program that is a few weeks long for different age groups, and we've done it for 3 years now, and each year there's been a different topic, and someone has developed a curriculum on faith, human development, faith development, and then what families can do, and that's available to different age groups. And then Sunday school is very much focused on getting the parents involved too, not just to be the kids there. And we just had a youth and family ministry vision to action workshop, And some of the things that came out was intergenerational service opportunities on a regular basis and getting everyone in the congregation involved in some sort of mentoring. And that's younger, older kids mentoring younger kids, youth mentoring a little bit older kids, adults mentoring. So I don't know where that's going to go, but it seems like if you offer it, people like it, and they are willing to do it. And start seeing it as something really fun, everything from the dad who comes and plays his accordion for first through third grade every Sunday and does, you know, and teaching first through third and doing the acting out of Bible studies you were talking about with the Jewish temple, synagogue. But it's I think people are pretty hungry for it. And if you get a lot of creativity there, people jump in and create their own ideas.
Yeah. I agree. I'm not a parent. I'm a godparent. And I struggle with what can I do to foster the faith of my godson. And I look to his parents who are young and both working full-time. And I think, what kind of tools can I give them to help them bring their faith, not into their home and bring it not just on a Sunday or a Wednesday night activity night, but bring it into their home, the little rituals that they can do each day. I think churches are very good at educating and having these programs of mentoring, but we don't have enough resources to help parents do the little things that would foster not just grace at the meal, but rituals that would bring it to life in the home every day. So it's not just about the relationship.
One thing that I think we've done in Christian education that has been backwards is I think we felt that if we offer enough Bible studies, that Bible study will lead people to share their faith. I think the opposite is true, that as we encourage mentoring within the congregation and more sharing of faith, people will be beating down the door for more Bible study. As they become more excited about the faith, then they want to grab the tools. But we've tried to hand out the tools first, and then we wonder why people aren't very excited about the tools when we haven't really, they haven't been become gripped with sharing the faith. So the Bible study will come if we can foster faith sharing.
I thought faith came from hearing the word.
Yeah, it does. It does. But as we share the faith, we hunger more to grow deeper in the Word.
There's a fairly good resource that Augsburg Fortress puts out, which is the kind of publishing house of the ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, called Nurturing God's Child. How many of you have heard of that little resource? It is a three-year program with a monthly mailing. So once a baby is born, right away you mail the first packet, and it has a variety of things in it, some music, they used to be little records, but now they're little tapes, and a growth chart, and a calendar of the first year, and a picture of Jesus by the crib, right? And then once a month, the parish, whoever is in charge of this program, mails just a two-page flyer that you fold into thirds and staple and address. And it has some things that are very positive. It tells about the social, physical, emotional, and spiritual development of a child falls very much a developmental process, so that a parent can read about the milestones that they might look for in the next month. Your child starts to smile, and if your child smiled the month before, you feel very superior. And that goes for 3 years. It's meant to help the parent in the home learn about the whole child and the child's growth. It takes them to 3 years, at which time then you enroll them in Sunday school. The piece of this program that is more rarely done, which I found most helpful my 5 years at Our Savior's Lutheran in Bellingham, Washington, is a monthly meeting where you gather all of the parents. Now, if you have a big congregation, you gather all the parents whose kids are born in this section of time. For us, it was all the parents who were getting this any mailing, so they had a child in the home from 0 to 3. And there, the nurturing of faith, part of it starts out sharing stories, and parents who are working on their second kid get to share their war stories with a brand new parent. What I found was nurtured was the faith and courage of the parents that would come home. And the one aspect that is not present in this that I supplemented was ritual life, domestic ritual, how to turn bath time every night into baptismal remembrance, how to name the parts the child grows up feeling at home in the body that God has given them, those kinds of things. But I felt that that was a very helpful resource, but it brought parents together who were undergoing the same kind of processes with their kids. What we found we had to supply was child care for older children and younger children so they could bring their children to the church. That was a great help, but it needed ritual. From my point of view, it did not call children into a Eucharistic community, and so that was the piece of it I had to write on my own.
As a parent here at Holden told me today that she's not here, so I can just tell this. that when her children leave for school in the morning, she makes the sign of the cross on each forehead and reminds them that they are a child of God. And she says if she ever forgets, they come back and say, "You forgot the sign of the cross." And I just think how these rituals become, they become what's the very best of ritual, and that is just something you do. And then that shapes and forms you into what you are. You become what you already are. And I don't think we've even begun to realize the power of ritual. We have depended too much on words, and the culture is beating us. Do you know what I mean? And the power of these little rituals.
There's a wonderful little book out. The structure of the book is based on the structure of the church's bedtime prayer, the Compline. So each piece of the Compline becomes a chapter in this little book. It's a lovely liturgical training publication book. And the author of this book has raised a passel of children. And she tells the story of doing that same thing, making the sign of the cross on them every time that they part. And that as the kids got older, there was this, the one son was sort of, not here. But he was headed off to, she talks about trying to pull them away from the bus before they head on a choir tour or to a ball game, make the little sign. And the son who had resisted the most in his adolescence, the day they took him to college, she was saying goodbye to him, and she noticed that that wasn't how it happened. This boy don't tell jokes. He came up to her. He's quite outgrown her, quite taller than she at this point at 18. And he came up to his mama and bent his head. And she said her first thought was he wants me to check his hair, so she fixed his hair. And, not that, and she brushed off his shoulders and she couldn't figure out what this child was doing. And finally, he says to her, "Mama, sign me. I'm going to college." And so it was, again, a sense of identity that you grow into knowing who you are. What does it mean to leave home for the first time and say, "I bear a mark that is going to tell me in tough times and in wonderful times and all those in-between times who I am"? When other voices begin to ask me or press me or pull me, I can be reminded where my identity is, where I belong, where my value is. The first time I remember being in college and getting a B on an exam, and I thought, I was so afraid. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. It was in biology, and I called home and I was weeping, and my mother thought probably something desperate had happened to me. And finally she went, what happened? I said, I got my first biology exam back, and did a car run over you on your way home from the exam? I'm home, Mom, I got a B. And there was this long silence. I thought, oh, she's going to say, you know, the tuition's cut off. It's all over now, you know, because these were unacceptable things in our, it was an unacceptable letter in our home except for our last name. And so she said to me, she says, well, who are you? I said, what do you mean? Well, who are you? Is this beyond this exam telling you you're somebody than the girl I sent to college? And I said, no. And so she said, you're God's child, Susan. And I said, oh, okay. She said, but study harder next time. I'd like to see an A on the final. So, I mean, there still was that works righteousness, but I, you know, that was her way of saying, I've raised you to know who you are. Now, don't let this, you know, shake you. And then that, I can tell that story because it's light and funny and, I mean, other things much worse than getting a B have happened to me. But I, what I hear is that, well, who are you? And she then at this point is saying, you tell me, honey, because I've told you for 17 years. Now you tell me who you are and who calls the shots about your value and your worth and your basic identity.
Which reminds me, I think one of the most memorable chapel sermons we ever heard at PLU was the president, Ricky, when he we asked him to preach in chapel, and he announced that he was not the president of the university. We all thought he was.
It was his opening line, I am not the president of Pacific Lutheran University.
Yeah, and then shared that, you know, this is my vocation,
my
role, but I am a child of God. I just thought, well, someone taught him that. You know, that. And that's all, isn't
it? Well, he was a member of our parish.
Right, he heard our preaching and everything.
It strikes me in all of these examples how the fostering of someone else's faith perhaps isn't depended on, but certainly is helped if the one who's doing the fostering is well-rooted. You know, that for your mother to say that meant that it also didn't, that she could say, I too am a child of God, even if my daughter got a B on an
even
exam.
Even if she never had one in her life.
Right, right. But that also, when you were told that other story, I thought, well, I wonder if this son is going to make the sign of the cross on his mother when he leaves. You know, that was the response, which I was getting, I have to say, all over my faith. My son was going like this. They learned it in Narnia today to make the sign of the cross. He's licking his finger and making it all over my face during Vespers. And it got to my mouth. It's, ooh, that's enough. But he didn't know enough not to do it on my glasses. But there's that, you know, the sort of exchange that Steve is talking about can come. But we have to be secure enough to say, yeah, I will spend a lot of time driving you around and sending you to this and that, not just to a soccer game, but other things as well.
I have a couple things to say. Just one is one thing that we do in our house that's, I don't know if you call it a ritual, but we sing all the time.
Yes, it
is. And 90% of the songs, 95% of the songs we sing are what you call them, church songs. I mean, you know, either hymns or Sunday school songs,
yeah,
or whatever. So the music and the repetitive, I think I was telling you, Susan, anyway, we got to listen to Hannah sing Mary and Tom's Holly, Holly, Holly song, a Hallelujah song, halfway back to the village from the falls. And it was driving me crazy, but it was, and also we didn't ask her to be quiet because she, at four, I mean, actually since she was able to speak or sing at all, has been singing Christ songs. So that's one way that we do is a lot of singing. And then I just wanted to ask a question of Dan. When you said, so I'm now skipping to another thing. When you said...
Before you do, can I say something about song? Song is such a wonderful vehicle for story, for telling the story. It's a way of education. The songs that are imprinted on us are really the songs of another story. And they're songs that make us odd as well. And I just, before you ask Danny's question, I have a wonderful story about songs. We sing a lot in our house. We have a song for almost every occasion. Yeah. They're not always Christian songs, but something always reminds us of singing. And one time, last winter, I was very sad, and I was crying. And my then 8-9-year-old sat down by me and said, "Well, what's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I can't really, I'm not sure what's wrong. I don't know why I'm so sad." And she just sat there, and I said, I don't have a song to explain this. There's no song I have. She just sat very quietly. And then she said, "No, I think we do have a song. We do have a song for this." And I said, "We do." And she said, "That one, we have that song about we hung up our harps on the willow tree. Uh-huh. How can we sing our songs in a strange land?" And we just moved here. We were new here. We were uprooted. We were away from family and friends. And I thought, she's got it. She has a whole different text, a whole different story, and a whole different songbook to help make meaning out of meaningless moments, like a mother who's crying and she can't make it stop. So I said, "That's right." So we got out the Psalter and read the song. This is our song for these moments. So I think song is a terrific way to foster faith and to teach the story.
Can I tell a story on that too? I have an acquaintance who is a rape victim who talks about how after that happened, as she was, abandoned and waiting to be discovered, sang hymns to herself, and that was really an important part, not only of her survival, but then later of her recovery, to know that from that moment, she just right back into that community that had taught her the song, so that she wasn't alone.
Mm-hmm. Now your question, Kate.
I'd like to add to that. but I appreciate Tom and Mary so much going around to the altar, because they're teaching us new songs. They're teaching us. Okay.
Yes, and a lot of songs in different languages. And mm-hmm. So my kids learning different languages, yes. and they don't necessarily know exactly what they're saying. But yeah, we like that too. Okay, my question was, you had said that it's important, as we're saying yes to our story, we have to say no to other stories. And I, in your examples, I agree with no to the story of violence and no to the story of money. But what about the stories that aren't our story but aren't necessarily really negative? You know, I mean, they're not the loaded stories that you were referring to. It's other faiths that aren't our story. What do you say when you're saying yes to ours without being judgmental or even patronizing, to the other real faith stories?
Yeah, that's really good. That's a good question.
Yeah. And you're going to answer it tomorrow, right? That's what you said.
I'll say something, and it's the kind of thing I'll wake up at 2 in the morning and think, "Oh, that would be good." But I just... And then it'd be fun to discuss some others to share, but I'm inclined to think that we need to change our definition of what other religions are. You know, that other religions are not Judaism, Islam, but other religions are the myths and stories that teach our children that violence is a way to establish good. That teach our children that buying things is a way of establishing worth. The stories that teach our children that being tough is the way you get, etc. These, that we need to start naming them as false religions over against belief in Jesus Christ. And I think within an identity in Jesus Christ, signed with the cross of Christ, I think we could be enriched by singing songs from our Jewish brothers and sisters and from other faith traditions, and I'd make my distinction more there than I mean, it's part of celebrating the God who
So you would say that our story has a particular storyline within a larger God story or something? Are you saying that then? So then, when we say yes to our what?
I don't know. I'd like to just discuss some more of it, because it's a great question. Is when we say no, you know, what are we saying no to? And I just kind of a first reaction that our no is not to stand up and say, I say no to Judaism because I'm a Christian. There's just something about that that doesn't feel like it's getting at the reality of what the seduction is and the other religions are that are... I don't know. Anybody else help?
Well, can't you just say, you know, different things and ways speak to different people? To always talk about it that way with your kids? Not that Lutheranism is it, or Catholicism, or... They're just different paths and different ways of understanding, and just like they're different languages, and people hear things through different means. I think you're absolutely right. The fear of the different denominations and different religions is worth the money, the violence, and those stories. Those are the...
Well, I think there are two. You're mixing things there. Different denominations isn't an issue at all. We're baptized into one church.
Well, it is for some people.
Well, but... I mean, that is, to me, that is a different question than other world religions.
Which were you?
She's asking about world religions.
Oh, okay. But people do get into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, the reason I asked the question was not just for philosophical, you know, and I'm also not, I appreciate the idea, though, of when you say yes to something, you need to say no to something that's counter, and I just wondered, you know, how far do you go in saying no? But you answer. I mean, you explain.
Yeah, part of it is the no isn't necessarily kind of a violent no. When you know, when you chose to marry one man, you were in a way rejecting all other men on earth. You know, when I choose to that Jesus Christ is my Lord, in a way, I am rejecting all. In a way. You know, I am rejecting all other families of
faith. And I think a distinction has to be made between not confessing someone else's religion and being willing to learn from the people whose confession you don't share. And it seems to me that we are in a time when a kind of violent or even doctrinaire opposition to people of faith with whom we have at least some strategic commonalities, like longing for world peace. You know, yes. I mean, you can't say, well, we all want peace, but you're wrong. But that it has to be a much more nuanced kind of response to in those kinds of situations than simply no. Just as it would probably have to be a more nuanced response to someone who confesses a Christian creed or even one's own denominational confession, but with whom one has big differences on ethical and social issues. So that, you know, and that's one of the wonderful things about a Eucharistic community, that there you are at the table looking across at someone you've been screeching at in a department meeting, thinking, ooh, what is going on here? Ooh, this is kind of odd.
In our congregation, we offered a class to our confirmants We have parent-student courses that are bonus courses during the year. We offer six of them, and only 12 students can sign up for each course. And the World Religions one was the first one to fill up, and we have to repeat it again this year because the waiting list is already full for World Religions. And we showed some 10-minute videos on the major world religions and then had discussions, got into terminology and how these people, their search for meaning has been answered in this religion. And parents said to me, some of our parents and families drive 20 miles to confirmation, and they said, thank you for the discussions we were able to have in the car. This never would have happened if we didn't have the opportunity to take these courses. So the church has given an opportunity for families to share what Christ means to them and how it may be different for a Hindu person who searches for God in that religion. So I think that the church is one place where this can happen.
One of the issues that you brought up earlier strikes a chord with me, the fact that it's so difficult for parents to relate to their kids about their faith. And the fact is that in our congregations, we're so highly segregated by age that we foster the very thing that we expect the parents to go home and deal with the kids. But in our congregational settings, we separate them up by age group, and nobody can meet with anybody else. And for instance, we'll have in our seminars, we'll have a topic like we had a fellow talking about AIDS. A physician and so forth, and we've had sessions about gays and lesbianism and so forth, and the kids are in another room. They should be in there with us, talking to us. But instead of the very thing we should be doing, they're off somewhere else. So this intergenerational thing, I think, if we did it more in church, it would help the parents to do it at home.
I wonder if other people have examples of things that you do in your congregation or your home that meet that kind of question, of helping the whole congregation to foster the faith of children and of one another.
Someone mentioned, he said something about the Tom Witt and Mary, you know, how you appreciated their thing. Well, something that I appreciated about Tom's father, Elmer, whom a lot of you know from Holden, is that I don't know how often he had done this with any of his other children, but when daughter Mary was ready to be confirmed, he arranged to select with her several people that they would visit together for these people to talk about their faith to Mary. You know, and I had never heard of that. And I thought, what a wonderful thing, what a wonderful gift of a father to a daughter within the family of faith, but also within the biological family to bring along an idea like that.
So we're hearing both what we do and what we say. Both of those need to be present. We have to have rituals. We have to explain them once in a while so that they aren't just something we do rather than the thing we do.
And one just small ritual that someone else did, and I wish I had gotten organized to do it yet, but Mother Teresa has a new book out, or one where there's a prayer in there, and it's a prayer that says, save me from the desire to be liked, to be, it has a list of things to save me from, and then a list of things to reach towards, and this particular mother reads that to her child every day as they go out the door. And it sounds, I don't have the book, but she shared it with us in a small group. It's a wonderful prayer. and I think getting what Dan is talking about what you're up against, kind of names some of the things that you're up against in the world and sets apart.
One of the privileges my children have had for the biggest 8 years in their lives so far, they were in a parish where there weren't any other children to speak of. What they had then were role models and friends and mentors who were young adults, 18 to 22 year olds, who had an extraordinary impact on their lives, a way that a parent couldn't, because a parent is expected to be a certain way, I think, in the eyes of the child, and expected to say certain things. But I could sit here and list a beautiful basket full of young adults who in many ways shared their own faith with my children. The woman who's going to come here soon named Sonia, who sat, because my husband and I are parents, we don't sit with our children in church, so we had to get other people to do that, but who taught Mary Emily how to read the liturgy in the book and how to follow it. Young adults who are making vocational decisions, what to do with their lives, who are making lifelong relational decisions, at those stages, to see, have my children see how they are bringing their faith in. Young adults who were struggling with their faith, who thought they'd lost it all, and would meet in our home for something we called the Doubters Diners Club. My kids being the only ones at the table at that point who could pray, because everybody else was in such, remember that? We all look like, who's going to pray? They're all in doubt, you know, so the kids do it. But that was a wonderful kind of intergenerational modeling and mentoring, and I don't think those young adults have much, they can't know what they did for my girls, who now want to be more, I mean, do you know, because they didn't know us at that age. So what I like about this intergenerational thing is it bridges gaps that parents can't bridge. And grandparents can bridge other gaps because they get to be 100% grace and gospel. They don't have to be law at all. And a parent has to be both law and gospel, wouldn't you say? But grandparents and godparents and aunts and uncles have this privilege of being pure gospel. All, you know, because they don't have to discipline.
So the Search Institute has been working, I don't know if it's only in the Midwest, where they have these healthy community initiatives. One is in Northfield, one is in Moorhead, and one of their findings is that one of the best predictors of whether children will come through adolescence well is if they have six adults who care about them. Mm-hmm. And that's where my historical research in Norwegian immigrant congregations, people always had four sponsors. Oh, isn't that interesting? You know, four sponsors and two parents, and if that really worked, that would be six adults who cared about you. That really,
I think, it'd be two sets of grandparents if you were lucky enough.
Yeah, right.
As a single person, I've been very fortunate to be a sponsor many times, and I want to be the best one I could to these young people. So from the beginning, I let them all know I was praying for them, and that seemed to be an opening. And then, of course, every relationship was different as it should have been, but it opened up a lot of things, and I've had wonderful relationships with all of them in ways parents can't.
That's right.
Would you give us some examples of how different relationships developed?
Well, with one, she was having a hard time in college. So I wrote her every week and encouraged her, and we developed a real friendship by mail that way. And with another one just recently, who's getting married this weekend, and I'll be at her wedding this weekend, she's her first year teaching this year, had a very difficult time. So I let her know regularly I was praying for her, because as a teacher I understood. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things. And now she and I are very close. So
that's great.
Anne's comment and yours bring to mind one thing that we're going to be doing this fall in our parish. We had someone from hospice come and talk to us about one-sentence prayers that are used with people who are in intense pain. And mm-hmm. you boil things down to your fear, your need, and that one-sentence prayer. We have 18 commissioned lay ministers, and when they heard this presentation, they said, do we have to you know, be in hospice to have a one-sentence prayer. And so we talked, we had these conversations, and as the chaplain prays this prayer for the people every day, and they pray this prayer. And so we had this agreement that we would have these prayer cards, and I would know the our commissioned lay ministers' prayers, one-sentence prayers, and would pray them regularly, and they would pray them. And the questions that were brought up is, what are your greatest fears? What are your greatest needs? And that's a tremendous opening to ministry. And we're going to be doing that with our conference this fall, the one-sentence prayers, and having their mentors praying for them, and also hopefully maybe the mentors sharing their one-sentence prayers.
So we're drawing to an end. Is there someone who wants one last word? And I'll
just say, I think baptismal anniversaries must be known and celebrated in a different way than a birthday, but with no less power and wonder. And Saints Day's names. We have a Magdalena whose Saints Day is July 22nd, and our Mary Saints Day is August 15. And these kids won't let us off the hook about remembering their Saints Day and reading the story of their saint from Scripture and how that means that they're called into it. So those, can you imagine a parent missing a child's birthday? That would be grounds for all probably suit later in life. But we forget to celebrate this other great day, which brings us into another family and into another story and into another life.
I think that's a good job for a grandparent to celebrate the baptismal day rather than the birthday.
Great. And a God
they always get presents and parties and things on birthdays, but they forget the baptismal day, and that's what I do with my grandkids.
Good for you. That's good.
Right. Thanks. I hope everyone heard something from someone they want to go and talk to them in the next days and have sparked some ideas for you. So thanks.
Thank you.